Hey everybody, we are honored to be joined today by Savanari M, MMA fighter, artist, warrior princess, and absolute savage.
Hi guys, thanks for having me.
Savanari, it's so nice to meet you. I was watching you had an MMA fight.
Yep.
And you knocked someone out. So what kind of knockout was that called when you had her on the ground like that? You had a full guard or?
Yeah. So I got top mount, and then I managed to pin one of her arms down, and just started ground and pound. So I won by a TKO with that.
Wow. It looked brutal. Those elbows.
Yeah. I surprised myself too, because fighting has always been something that's been just the very opposite of my nature. So it's kind of weird going in there and doing that, and especially watching myself, and I just look so mean. But at the same time,
I don't think you looked mean. You just looked extremely formidable. Like, I wouldn't want you to be angry at me.
Okay.
I was like, oh my goodness. I was like watching you in the ring. I was like, my goodness. I don't think I would stand a chance.
What was your mentality like during the fight? Like, you've had other fights before, as well as all the multiple sparring sessions you've had in the gym. At that point, was it already a matter of you knew exactly what you were going to do and you felt pretty confident, or was there still a bit of unsurety?
Yeah, exactly. Unlike my first two fights, one second, I need my doggy. My first two fights, I mean, I was pretty relaxed for my first couple fights, and I didn't feel too much as far as anxiety or nerves, but this one, I was extremely relaxed. Just the amount, because I've been working with a new coach for these past couple months, and just the amount of work and the preparation that we put into this camp, I just felt like there was nothing that my opponent can do that I wouldn't be ready for. So yeah, I was afraid, you know, this is my first time fighting under a big organization. I'm in a different country. I'm halfway across the world. And I was afraid, like, you know, the lights and the crowd and all that would kind of get to me, but it actually, you know, all of that, the lights and the crowd, it actually fed my mood and my composure and all that. So
were you her first defeat?
No, she's had, I want to say her record was like 10-3. So yeah, so she had that, her experience was on her side. You know, I've only been in the cage two other times, and she's had 13 fights total, and she's fought for one already once before. So, and she was a taller opponent, but, it felt okay going in there. So
be sure to check out our new Levin Jewels store. We're selling original t-shirts artfully designed by the two of us, yours truly.
And if you want to support us, you can sport a fashionable wardrobe today, courtesy of the Levin Jewels store on Shopify.
Shopify is a great service that works with PayPal and Google Pay. So if your credit card information's already installed with them, you can click on over and join our underground movement today.
Was your brain turned off? You were just going with the flow, or did you still have to, like, I don't know when exactly the instinct kicks in of, I know exactly what I have to do at a certain time.
Initially, when she threw the first punch, I think instinct kind of kicked in, and what happened was she grabbed my head, which is something that we've been training so long for her not to do, but she managed to get it anyway. And but that's okay, because we had a response for if she did grab my head, so I managed to get the takedown and just work from there. So everything just felt like, it just felt like I've been doing it a million times, which is exactly what I have been doing. So,
and like you mentioned before, you are a extremely gentle person. Like, all the photos I see of you, you're always smiling. You're always with, even right now, you're with this beautiful creature. So how exactly did you end up in MMA? What was the influence? What's the story?
My partner now, Daniele, he introduced me into boxing about 6 years ago, And I was training boxing. I was doing really well. And a couple of years into that, I was introduced to jiu-jitsu and was doing well. I was competing in tournaments and stuff. And around that time, women's MMA was kind of kicking off with Ronda Rousey, kind of really a big name in the UFC. And we kind of had a connection. So a friend of ours kind of put me in touch with people to kind of get me in my first professional MMA fight. So yeah, so that happened about 2 years ago. I had my first MMA fight. I wasn't really well trained in MMA quite yet. I mean, a little bit. I mean, I've been training in kickboxing and in wrestling and a little bit of things here and there. But it wasn't until this past year that I started really putting everything together. And yeah, that's kind of how it started. I've always had a love for martial arts and fighting, but I never actually had the opportunity to actually train it until 6 years ago. So that's how it started.
And you've made so much progress, and you've been an artist for longer than that, a digital artist or an illustrator.
I've been drawing all of my life ever since I was a kid. And then, right out of high school, I went to the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising in LA for their digital media program. So we learned, we're kind of a jack of all trades when it comes to, you know, so like video editing, sound design, graphic design. So we knew how to work Photoshop and all that. And then, I'd get gigs for various digital media projects. And then as far as the digital art stuff, that's kind of something I picked up on my own later. Like I would see, concept art for video games and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. I didn't know you could do that in Photoshop. So I got myself a Wacom tablet and just started, drawing from there. So
you have a very active imagination. Like some of the stuff that I've seen you draw, it's so surreal. Like this one voodoo drawing, which has a fish for a foot, and I don't know what kind of creature is coming out of the stomach. It's got a very interesting set of teeth.
Yeah. That was a friend of mine just gave me that idea. I was like, oh, that sounds crazy and weird enough for me to try. So that was one of those where I just had to create.
And the later reactions that you got with the samurai girl who you mentioned, and the one where you're on top of Daniele is on top of a horse, and you are on top of Daniele.
Yeah.
Like how did all of this get started? Was it Daniele who was influencing you with all of his harrowing tales of things that happened in the past?
Yeah, probably. I think he's definitely had a big influence on my way of thinking. I feel like when we first met, you guys kind of know a little bit about his whole philosophy and everything he talks about. And it's stuff that I feel like I was kind of already living, but I never really heard it put into words. So it all really clicked with me. And then finally, I was able to put kind of that stuff, that philosophy into some of my art. So
I want to circle back a little bit for our audience. So your boyfriend, Daniel Bellelli, it was a coincidence. I've read his book. I've read one of his books, Create Your Own Religion.
Nice.
That book was amazing. I found that on Amazon. It was recommended to me. And I picked it up, and then I found out through Lev that he had been on the Joe Rogan Experience. But the experience I got reading that book was extremely mind opening, because I was baptized, but then I wasn't very religious growing up. My mom teaches Sunday school at a Unitarian church, which is like their symbol is like a kumbaya circle around the globe, and everyone's welcome. So it's like Buddhists and Muslims and Jews and Christians and like everyone. And I remember being there and raising my hand saying like, what if you're an atheist or an agnostic or something? And they're like, oh yeah, you're welcome here as well. And I was like, oh, it didn't make sense to me at the time, but I've learned so much through Lev about different religions as well. And so I started talking to Lev before reading Create Your Own Religion. And I started finding, like, when you think about religions as thought technologies or like people organize in different ways. And if you look at their traditions or their spiritual traditions or the lore and the stories that they tell, there's a lot of wisdom. And I feel like mental side effects to a lot of these things. And I think that a lot of pop culture lacks in some of this dialogue. I feel like some people feel like this is taboo territory. And that's very interesting to me, because I think there's also like a desire. People have a craving for, I mean, I don't want to call it taboo pushing, because that's really not what it should be, but some things are taboo that I think shouldn't be. And I feel like it holds people back from having like cathartic or wise conversations. And I was just very impressed with the scope of the book. I was shocked to learn. I just learned recently that was the connection. I put it all together.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. I always tell him all the time, like, I kind of wish I didn't know him so closely. I did read one of his books before we started getting really close. It was On the Warrior's Path. And I was able to have that, that mind-blowing effect. Like, wow, everything he says is just so beautiful, and everything clicks so well with me. But for some reason, like, now that I know him, and I guess we've had so many conversations reading the books, it doesn't have the same effect on me. Like, I have to kind of put myself in, you know, like someone from the outside in their shoes to kind of like, but it's really hard sometimes. So, so reading some of his books, it's like, I mean, I know how amazing he is. It's just, it doesn't have the same effect on me. But yeah, I know what you mean about everything you just said. But
well, one thing that stood out to me, a lot of things did, but he's talked about different brands of Taoism, how there's harsh like schools of Taoism and then more compassionate schools of Taoism. Apparently a school of Taoism that focuses on like energy vampirism, like holding people down in order to elevate yourself. And then there's types of Taoism that are, it's the complete opposite of that. And there's something about that really disturbed me, like just like acknowledging that some people might like incorporate into a religion, whether consciously or unconsciously, like that there are ways of, you know, like negatively or corrosively like oppressing or dominating people to their own detriment, and somehow that gives people like an extra boost. And it was such a weird thing to see diagnosed in a category of Taoism, because I would imagine that was something that would be easy to find people universally appalled by. But I guess that was it made me think about, you know, other religions, like whether it was the Aztecs or, you know, because people, I understand why people think like religions are taboo, because if you look at like Orthodox Christians or any like really fanatical religious person, it seems like there's a lot of room for it to go wrong, right? Like, I feel like there's a lot of, Lev, maybe you can help me out here. Maybe you hear what I'm trying to talk about, because we've been talking about religion so much lately that I feel like we've lost touch with how it's still an uncomfortable subject for a lot of people, right? You know, I'm agnostic. I tell people I'm an atheist who believes in God, but I think that, you know, these deep questions about the nature of things and how can we organize and work together and understand ourselves and the universe, I mean, these are questions that are as old as time.
Well, as far as something like Buddhism goes, the thing that I'm curious about, let's say, Theravada Buddhism, for instance, that was heavily present and is still heavily present in Cambodia, which from what I understand, Savanri, like you're getting much more in touch with now that you're being exposed to Southeast Asian culture a lot more. And what I'm curious about is there seems to be this whole life that we're living in right now, some kind of reason for all of these things to exist. Yet with Buddhism, it seems like the idea there is that anything, no matter whether it's happiness, love that we experience, the love that we give to other people, all of that is fleeting. It'll all go away. It'll come back. Then it'll go away again. Where the best thing is to just literally not exist, to go extinct. That, from what I understand, is the state of nirvana, to cease existence once and for all. But then the question that gets to me is, then why even have this whole thing to begin with? Is it just like this game of existence for the sake of then non-existing anymore? Like, I'm curious if you've thought about that and what your thoughts are. It's
heavy. A little bit too much. Whoa, how did it,
I want to throw it out there. Why not? It's not a complicated thing, right? Like, it sounds deep, but it is pretty simple.
Save me, Jules.
I don't know. Yeah, Lev. I asked Lev for the life preserver there to help me with the religion topic, and then Lev is talking about like annihilation of self, and it's like, bro, how did we get there? Like zero. But
that is
60.
The core. That is the Lev. core tenet of Buddhism. There's no getting around that. So it's something that I think about.
And
I
don't know, but are you a Buddhist?
I mean, I grew up around it because my grandparents were Buddhist, and we'd go to temples together all the time. And but everything was in Cambodian. I didn't really understand. I was just kind of around it. You know, it was just cool being around the monks and everything. I'm just starting to kind of delve into understanding, Buddhism a little bit. You know, since I'm going to be in these Southeast Asian countries, I would like to understand. I feel like it would help me understand the culture a little bit more. But yeah, I don't know too much about everything. Lev was just trying to.
Yeah. No, let's ignore what he said, and maybe we can circle back.
I grew up with a Christian background, along with, I guess, with a Buddhist background. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
That's very interesting. Are you familiar with Sam Harris at all?
I've heard of the name. I'm sure I've heard of some of his ideas.
He's a neuroscientist, and he loves Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book called Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion. And he talks about a lot of the empirical claims of Buddhism, but he complains that a lot of Buddhist teaching is entangled with mysticism that obscures some of the empirical claims.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of Buddhism, there's a lot of if you're reading texts and you're searching for the wisdom through a lot of ancient Buddhist texts, there'll be a lot of contradictions and things that are paradoxes and don't make sense. And I guess, Lev, what you mentioned, I think would be one of the concepts of Buddhism that Sam Harris would probably lament and think that it was a poverty of language problem and it wasn't being articulated. I think Buddhism, like when you talk about that kind of like inner peace, I love the Anubis metaphor from Egypt mythology, where he's there in the afterlife and he weighs your heart with a feather. And if your heart is heavier than the feather, then you go to hell. And if it's lighter than a feather, you go to heaven. And I feel like it's kind of like a mindset. It's like, imagine someone in a Chinese finger trap and then being really anxious and then like panicking. And so they're just trying to like pull it apart. But it makes them stuck.
Mm-hmm.
When the way you solve the Chinese finger trap is you relax, you bring your fingers close together, and then you just like peacefully separate. And I feel like that kind of puzzle, when you think about your anxiety as a reaction, if you're on a bike and you're about to get hit by a car, they say you should relax your body before the car hits you to improve your chances. It's easier said than done, obviously. But I think that's what the Anubis metaphor is supposed to prepare people's minds for as a thought technology. As in, when you're passing over, you want to be relaxed and kind of guide your trip like you would try to guide a psychedelic experience or something else. So I, Lev, if you're talking about goals in Buddhism for enlightenment, I imagine that goal is to accomplish like the positive side of the Anubis metaphor. That's how I would interpret what you said. So I'm trying to not leave Lev's question open-ended or unanswered, but
I can't answer that as well. As far as the extinction thing, it sounds very dire and dramatic, and I don't think there's even a need to I don't think there's a need for that to be known at this point, because all the other benefits that come with something like meditation, you could already see them in your life. Like if you practice meditating, let's say 15 minutes per day for about a week, I've noticed, at least personally, a lot of positive results happening from that. And the only weird thing about it is when you get these Buddhist meditators, these Buddhist monks that were hooked up to some machine, Jules, you know about this more than I do, their brain signals were very similar to those of, sociopaths?
Sociopaths, psychopaths, they're the same. The literature and all this stuff is mostly bunkum. That's it's like if you read a psychology textbook like of mental disorders, like everyone has a lot of mental disorders because it's all based on testimony. It's not based on like a blood test or a genetic test. It's based on a person with preconceived notions and prejudices asking someone, and the way you ask the questions, you know, the tone of your voice, your tenor, your treble, you know, you can ask one question in a way that makes someone anxious, and you can ask the same question in another way that makes them calm. And so if you have someone with a PhD and the glasses and the clipboard and they're asking you questions, you can see how unreliable it is. But when it comes to like that kind of emotional control, or just the like the aesthetic of someone's mental schematic that you can see through an fMRI scan, the Buddhist monks and the alleged psychopaths or sociopaths were indistinguishable. And I think it says a lot about how little people understand about mental health and spirituality, and how terrible these mental health guides are, because these are the same guides that encourage people to be on these SSRIs and these antidepressants. And doctors don't prescribe things like fitness, which is what you do. Like I imagine like all your fitness, like you're glowing. Like I've seen a lot of photos of you and you're smiling and you're glowing. And do you think that comes from your fitness, or does that come from spirituality, or what are your secrets to like being present and joyful?
Well, I feel like it's kind of unfair. I feel like that's kind of just part of my DNA. I've always just kind of been just really mellow and easygoing and kind of go with the flow. But I feel like ever since I've started training martial arts, that's been a huge thing. Cause you know, when you're doing three hard rounds, you know, getting punched in the face, getting beat up, after that, you know, your day can only be amazing.
So, and all that workout is supposed to increase the endorphins in your
body. Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously, yes, exactly. It's a combination of all of those things. So,
and do you meditate as well?
I mean, I don't know. I'm sure I have a version of meditating. Like I, especially before a fight, I like to kind of sit and close my eyes. I'm not in like an across legged position or anything. I'm just like maybe on the couch and just kind of,
Well, in a way, fighting is a form of meditation as well. If you're concentrating on a particular thing, then...
Yes, yeah, as my, like, I mean, I was doing a lot of the physical training, but there was also a lot of, I had to force myself to do a lot of mental training where I had to picture the fight going 3 5-minute rounds, kind of imagining all the possible outcomes, not just me dominating and conquering, which is great, but I have to be prepared if, you know, I'm like, my big punch doesn't work. So there was a lot of, and also kind of imagining the crowd and just so that none of that comes as a surprise to me. So I mean, to me, that's my meditation. And so, yeah.
One of my favorite quotes, I think it was someone, it might've been someone else's quote, but it was in the Create Your Own Religion. It's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war.
Right.
Do you remember that?
I've heard it. I don't remember who. Yeah, I've heard it. I don't.
I feel like that's you. I feel like you're a warrior in a garden. I get that. I get that feeling in terms of, you know, it. That's the thing that I feel like a lot of people that don't train in martial arts don't realize, that it's like, it's not even a pro aggression or pro fighting thing as much as it is like a pro self control, pro self defense, like pro, like synergy between mind, body, soul, and, you know, treating your body as a temple. And like people, you know, they hear like getting punched in the face. Like, how is that treating your body like a temple? But
yeah. I feel like, I just completed this children's book I've been working on with a UFC veteran, Eve Edwards, and another friend, Brooke James. And it's kind of teaching kids and their parents a little bit about, you know, because a lot of parents may be reluctant to put their kids into martial arts because they feel like it's teaching them violence. And I guess what we're kind of doing with our book is teaching them that, you know, martial arts is more than, you know, having the skill to dominate another human being. It's more about like bettering yourself, taking care of your own body and you know, discipline and just having courage and respect. That's kind of everything that we're kind of, that's going into this book right now.
What's the book called?
It's called The Talent Quest. I think Joe Rogan just mentioned it on the, I'm sorry, Eve Edwards was on Joe Rogan's podcast recently and he talked about it a little bit, but we should be releasing it pretty soon if we haven't already. We're working on it. It's kind of, we're going through the publishing and all that, but.
That's exciting.
So, yeah, I'm super stoked about it. It's perfect because I've been wanting to make a children's book for forever and this is like the perfect combination for me because it's martial arts mixed with like, you know, cartoon animals. So I had a lot of fun with it.
Well, you and Joe Rogan and Daniele and all of these influencers, you guys seem to be raising an army of anti-fragile kids. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with this term, anti-fragile. Jules was the one who was responsible for getting me invested in it. And I'm reading right now the book Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb. And I think because Jules read the whole thing, he'd be able to say it a little bit better than I can at this point of what exactly anti-fragile means. And I really see it being applied to you as well as the positive influence you're going to have on people.
Anti-fragile are things that become stronger with stress, but they also become weaker when you deprive them of stress, and they break if you give them too much stress. So if I went to the gym and try to put 600 pounds on the bar and try to lift that, that'd be too much stress and I would break my body, right? If I never went to the gym and never lifted the bar, my body would dilapidate, but I have to put on that appropriate amount of stress, tears the muscles, they grow back stronger. So that's an idea of anti-fragility. The Hydra from Greek mythology, when you would cut off one head and two would grow back, that's an anti-fragile mythical beast as opposed to the phoenix, which is resilient, right? Because it never changes. If you kill the phoenix, it comes back the same, but it's not stronger. It doesn't compound like the Hydra does. So that's anti-fragile. So okay. Stronger from stress.
Right. Absolutely. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen a lot of that in just being around Daniele's daughter, Isabella. She's 9 years old now, but she's changed so much since, she's also growing, but last year she was not as willing to try things. She was just always afraid of other kids judging her. And so she, you know, we'd have her in basketball class and she would just be a wreck every time we tried to get her to try anything new. And just this year we got her into Taekwondo and for whatever reason, I think the way they run the classes and the way they have the kids practicing their forms and they have the kids doing this ki, so they're always like screaming really loud, and something about that gets, you know, the kids' confidence and their energy up and just this fire in them. And just this few months of doing Taekwondo, she's been such a different child, just trying everything, just so much happier, more confident, just willing to try all kinds of different physical activities now. So
was she the inspiration for your children's book?
That was the children's book was actually Eve's concept. I'm just the artist, and it just kind of, it was just perfect because it clicked with me. And I just feel like now we have Isabella as this perfect example for, you know, what our book is trying to put out there. So
I wish more kids could follow her example. There seems to be, unfortunately, the more creature comforts we have as a civilization, the more we have these helicopter parents who are so afraid of letting their kids go out and play in the dirt and just get this anti-fragility, which thankfully Isabella's getting and the kids who are going to read your book are also going to be getting. But how could we expand this? What you're doing right now, what Joe is doing, what Daniela is doing, this is a spearhead in the culture war of being able to change people's minds about this stuff, like fighting. But I don't know how many people are hearing the message. I hope more are, but what could be done? I want to lend you as much support as possible in order to reach out to more people, like throughout all the decades to follow.
Just talking about it like we are, like Joe Rogan is, and the way Eve is, you know, came up with this concept and creating this book with us. I think that's kind of what we're trying to do with Talent Quest. So,
do you ever foresee in the future having your own dojo, having some place where kids could go to and train with you?
Danny and I talk about that quite often, but not so much with kids, but more so for like a women's kind of thing, like a women's retreat where we'd learn, you know, we'd study martial arts, maybe learn a little bit about how to safely use firearms, maybe have like a meditation center. That's kind of I don't know how tangible it is at the moment, but that would be like a beautiful thing that I really,
sounds brilliant.
Yeah. So I have a friend that she's beautiful. She teaches yoga and she's great in meditation and she does like the Wim Hof breathing and stuff. Mm. And then I can handle, she can handle the self side of yin and yang. And then I can help with the, you know, the martial arts side and the other side. So it's like this beautiful combination of, you know, strong and soft. So, but particularly for women.
That's amazing. And Joe Rogan was talking about how if things get real bad in California, he wants to go back to Colorado and maybe set up some compound there with his best friends so they could just live there, grow their own food and hang out. That may be, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know what's going to happen to the big cities in New York, California, but I think having a kind of self-sufficiency and a network where I know you, and you know, I'm not saying that I want to live in Joe Rogan's comp. I wouldn't be opposed to it. But, however it ends up working out, I think it's going to be helpful for people who care about these things and know that they could get along with each other, that they could be good neighbors, to be able to communicate and in the future have these various communities where, like, I think this may happen, let's say, with something like seasteading, for instance, which is this concept that was on Joe Rogan's podcast as well. There was the guy from the Seasteading Institute, and it's basically about these islands that float on the water that people can attach to and get detached from and just go to different islands. They have different laws. They have different systems of government. And that way, certain islands that are just floating in the sea could get more empowered and be much more productive based on the way that their system works. And you're not stuck to being in one particular place. And I think some of the Native American tribes had a similar thing going, where if you didn't like your chief, you could go on over to another tribe, to the more popular chief, and that'll be that. Like, I don't know if it's exactly going to happen with seasteading, but that concept itself I find to be really fascinating, and it may be what's going to happen in the future for people if things don't work out so well with the system that we have. But I don't know, like, are you...
Lev sounds very pessimistic about our system. It sounds like he's the sky is falling or something, but like, I think the system could be fine, and we could also have seasteading. It's not like the only reason we'll have seasteading is if, you know, it's like Escape from New York, Kurt Russell time. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
That's interesting, though. I'm very curious to kind of dig into that seasteading stuff, though. It's cool enough just to be living on this moving island where you're just, basically on an island. So, yeah, that's a very interesting concept. I dig it.
Where are you? Are you in California right now?
Yes, we're in the Big Bear Mountains.
So. Oh, I love Big Bear. I spent my last Christmas in Big Bear.
Oh, really?
No. There, yeah. And I went skiing. They have some skiing close by, mm-hmm. don't they? They have... It's really nice. It was and what's the temperature is the same here. I'm in LA right now. I'm in Koreatown.
Oh. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We have some snow up here. It's beautiful. We have some snow, but it's also sunny, so it's not like you can go outside and in a hoodie and jeans. So, cuz I don't like the cold. So, this is nice for me.
Have you started doing a bit of the Wim Hof method yourself, even though you don't like the cold?
I don't like, it's weird. I don't like cold water weather, but I can handle like cold water just fine. Like, Danny and I both experimented a little bit with the Wim Hof, and I practiced the breathing. I feel like that's actually helped a lot with my conditioning, and it's been like a big part of my training. And then we've done the ice bath, and yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it felt good for me. Danny, not so much. He nearly died. Oh, no. not literally, but he doesn't like the cold very much. Cold water. He likes the mountains. But,
I do not like that cold water. Lev showed me, there's a bathhouse in New York, and like, Lev was in this, it felt like Titanic water. It was like negative 40 degrees or something. Like, I don't know how they do it. And Lev would just like sit in there and like try to have a conversation. And I'd be like, my brain isn't working anymore. Like, I don't know how anyone can function. And then there was a sauna, it was 150 degrees or 120 degrees. It's just madness.
I just keep going in and out.
You've done it. You work Wim Hof breathing, Lev?
I do. I do it almost every day, and I did it to such a point that I've been secreting this possibly psychedelic chemical called DMT naturally from being able to do it. So it gives me all kind of psychedelic visions. Like, people have all these religious concepts of the third eye chakra and this triangle shape that's supposed to represent the trinity of Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. And all of this stuff, including the DNA helix, I am able to see in my mind's eye. Not like I'm just imagining it, but that it is literally there when I close my eyes in front of me. So I think this kind of these kind of stressors and these techniques that have been talked about in various books, and the Tibetan Buddhists also have a similar thing called Tummo, I believe, when they breathe and they come out of an ice cold lake, and people put these blankets on them, which are also ice cold, and they're supposed to heat those blankets up with their body.
Wow.
So this is like a very ancient thing, part of which we know about, but I'm sure there's an even bigger part. Like if you go the Graham Hancock route, there are supposedly ancient civilizations that have disappeared, that were wiped out by a comet or something of the sort 12,000 years ago. And a lot of the stuff that we're experiencing right now is in a way a reenactment of something that happened before, where these things keep on going and then they're destroyed and then they're rebuilt again. So like Graham Hancock says, we may be a society full of amnesia, where we think that it's this linear path that, look at us, we're so smart now. Meanwhile, there's all this other stuff that, thanks to folks like Wim Hof, we're just discovering that our own bodies are capable of. Stuff that's, you know, that's just written in various Hindu descriptions of Kundalini and the chakras and all this stuff that some people take to be just pure woo. But as far as physically experiencing it, I don't really know what's going on there, but there's definitely some kind of a secret system that's being activated.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, a buddy of mine, he swears by it. He's been doing it for the past few months now, and he's just his overall health and flexibility is improved, and his strength, which is like, so he wants me to really incorporate it more into my training, because it obviously can have some obvious benefits for me as an MMA fighter. So,
absolutely. Yeah. I think the ice bath is necessary, though, because what I noticed is that if I do it too much, I get high to the point where it really does feel like you're on this drug where it slows you down a little bit, where you just want to sit down and just breathe and relax and not really do anything. So that may be a bit of an issue, but I think that not just with the ice bath, but also with the training that you do, like right now, after seeing videos of you and other MMA videos, I want to go back to doing jiu-jitsu. I did it before. I did it for a little while, and I loved it. When you're able to be there with somebody else who you know doesn't want to kill you, but is experienced enough to know how exactly you can be choked out to the point that you're not going to die, you're going to be okay, but you're still going to have that bit of a experience of, you know, just this challenge that you have to overcome, this stressor that you have to fight against. And in a way, what you guys are doing, it is in a way like having, like, people talk about Burning Man being a bit of a mystery school, like especially if you incorporate LSD into the mix. But in a way, I think all these different fighting camps, all these dojos are mystery schools in their own, because people do in a way face sudden danger, they face death. Hopefully not really, but they face a portion of it. And when that happens, the rest of your life doesn't seem to be as dramatic, doesn't seem to be as something that you have to cry over or complain about, that you're not getting Wi-Fi signal on the airplane and all that kind of stuff. So I just want to say, like, God bless what you're doing and what you're gonna keep on doing right now. Like, you are an inspiration to many people, I'm sure, in Southeast Asia. Right now you're getting pretty famous. People are hearing about you. People are hearing about you in Cambodia. Have you been in touch with people from Cambodia after this? Have you been getting fan mail?
Yeah, lots of, you know, I'm trying to bump up my social media, and a lot of the new followers, a lot of the names are in, like, written in squiggly lines. It's so Cambodian characters. But yeah, I've even before my fight, some Cambodian media contacted me to be interviewed. And then even when I was in Malaysia, I got to speak with some more Cambodian media, and I learned, because I had no idea, but like, they already, like, a lot of people in Cambodia are already aware of my presence in the, you know, the MMA scene. So that was quite flattering. I had no idea this would happen so fast. So I'm pretty excited. I really look forward to being out there, because, like I said before, and many times, my mom came here from Cambodia, fleeing with her family from the Khmer Rouge, and you know, growing up in America, I kind of lost touch lost touch with my Cambodian roots. So just being able to go out there and meeting everybody and fighting out there eventually, I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about Cambodian culture and all that.
So. Well, in a way, what you're doing right now may also be a stopper for a future Khmer Rouge, whether it happens here in America or in Europe or wherever, because when people are able to defend themselves, when they are able to be self-sufficient, there's not this need to have a Pol Pot-type figure that'll tell everybody what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully that message is going to get into more people's heads, and you're definitely helping in the spreading of that message by being a living example. And one other thing I also wanted to ask you has to do with the...
Well, Lev, before yes. you... Can you please, for our audience, can we talk about what that historical event was? Can we define it?
Sure, absolutely. So there was this horrible Cambodian genocide that happened from 1975 to 1979, where about 21 to 24% of Cambodia's population ended up dying. About 60% ended up being killed, not just from not just dying from starvation, but just getting shot. And it's around 1.671 to 1.871 million people died during this time. So it's a really horrible thing.
And they had a population of 8 million. They had a population of 8 million, you told me?
Yes.
So it's like one out of four people died, basically.
Scary stuff. And I'm really thankful that your parents were able to escape. Do you know how they were able to do so?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to ask my grandpa much about it, but from what my mom kind of remembers, and my grandpa had, you know, he'd done some time in the Cambodian military, and he was pretty high up in the ranks and stuff. So somehow he was able to know, he was able to know exactly when it was time to run and exactly how to dodge any danger and keep his family safe. So there was there's plenty of times when, you know, they were running and there were, my mom recalls bullets whizzing past her head and seeing kids step on mines so plenty of things. And just, they barely, from what she's telling me, she barely got out of there. But but thanks to my grandpa and his connections, they were able to escape.
So. Was it a communist genocide, or was it at all related to what was going on in the area around that time? Or
it was supposed to be a socialist agrarian republic, where, from what I understand, the reason why people who wore glasses like me ended up getting the bullet was because they wouldn't be as good a farmer. Like, there's no need to have, according to Pol Pot, these middling people who are responsible for, you know, like, if you think like lawyers, bankers, people like that, even though I think for all the bad things that lawyers and bankers do to the world, these third parties are responsible for various transactions that are always occurring. And it is definitely part of our civilization, part of modern civilization, people being able to trade with each other. So, I mean, I'm not singling them out as the only people who got executed, but just this very childlike mentality that, oh, everybody could just live on the farm and be one with nature, and mm-hmm. we're going to force this on everybody. Like, that is, and again, I don't know if it's just evil or whether it's evil disguised in one's head as doing a social good for the future of humanity. But that's definitely one of the things that I want to avoid, those, you know, like that quote, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Like, I want to do something that's going to make this utopia on Earth, and I don't care how many people I have to kill in order to enact it. Like, that is worse to me than people who are just greedy and just want the money.
It is, it's crazy to, when you think about, you know, I think a lot of Americans, you know, Mark Twain said Americans invented war so they could learn about geography or something, which is like a terrible backhanded insult on Americans and how It's sort of like, I think a lot of them, they don't have historical awareness or geographical awareness. And so, you know, you know, government can brand itself in a lot of ways, but I don't understand this newfound faith in like a nanny or totalitarian government to socialize or centralize everything. And I guess, you know, I hear people talk about, you know, how America messed up in the Vietnam War, or how we overreacted to how we responded to communism in the past. And these things have all been redefined. And I'm wondering, because you have a closer experience than maybe a lot of people, a lot of millennials do, with the subjects of socialism and communism. I wanted to know if you have any, you know, if you have any experience, or whether it's family conversations about, you know, communism and whether it's or socialism in Cambodia or Vietnam or anywhere in that Asian region.
Mm-hmm. I've only just recently started asking my family, like my mother and my aunts and even my kickboxing teacher of their experiences, because it's obviously it's a hard topic to bring up, you know, and it's hard for me to ask these questions too, especially, you know, because it's like, because I'm forcing them to recall these horrible memories, and I don't know too much. They don't go too deep into the politics, mainly just about their own personal experiences, and that's kind of, I'm kind of like doing my own, you know, like reading books that were from authors that also grew up around during the Khmer Rouge and stuff, and Lev actually taught me a lot more just now, so I'm still learning as far as the political side, but so far it's just kind of asking family about their own personal experiences, and even that's kind of tough. Like, the Cambodian media asked me like how from their experience, they talked to the parents of some Cambodian fighters, and the parents are like saying how it's really hard for them to see their children get into this, you know, violent sport when they'd spent so much time getting away from violence. Whereas my family has the opposite reaction, like, they're stoked for me to be like doing what I'm doing with MMA, and like the violence doesn't really, but I asked one of my uncles about it, and he says like my family is like, they're able to separate like, what I'm doing, because it's not like a forced violence, you know, it's not a forced violence. It's, we're doing this by choice. For the most part, I'm learning a little bit more about even Cambodian fighters. Like, it's not really like, for me, I'm doing this because it's fun for me and I'm good at it. Whereas over there, they need the money. And so a lot of humbling things that I'm learning as I get closer to, you know, the Cambodian people. But
well, its economy is growing, as I've read. So they are developing, and I'm sure pretty soon we're going to be seeing a lot of bubble tea places there, in case they're
yes, I love that. I love bubble tea. It's more.
What's your favorite flavor?
It's always been, I'm just Thai iced tea is kind of my favorite, and recently ube.
All right, I like taro.
Yes, exactly, taro. Ube. Taro, yeah.
So Savonari, the last thing that I'm really curious about is, you have your own shop, and I would love for you to give out what that shop is, how people can buy your stuff, and what kind of stuff you're selling.
Okay, yeah. Through my website, I'm primarily selling wall scrolls, which is pretty awesome. The way they the way my art comes out on it, I'm pretty excited how it looks. But yeah, there's the most famous one is, or you know, the more popular one is the EQ Sojun drinking the wine off a lady's boob. And then we also have a variation of the EQ one. He's it's funny to talk about. It's easier to just draw it and post it and like, here you go.
Is that the one on the horse?
There's that one. That's the trifecta one where it's like my three things to happiness is food, fighting, and fucking. And then I'm sorry, I don't know. I didn't ask if I can say curse.
Yes.
And then there's the second EQ one where he's in the kitchen with a lady and he's, you know, pleasuring her. And I don't remember. I have to check. And then there's like, I think there's links to the Fight Chicks website where they sell like t-shirts with my art on it. So like Tomoe Gozen shirts and Savage Buddha shirts.
The website that I got was SavannahM.com. And I remember knowing you as Savannah M before Savannery. Now, Savannery is your actual name and Savannah is like a nickname or...
Yeah, Savannery or Savannery is the name that I was given. It's just that my mom taught me how to write Savannah as kind of just like the American adaptation. So that's what I've been going with. But since I'm trying to do this, you know, since I'm an MMA athlete in Southeast Asia now and making a presence there, I'm kind of happy to do it too because it's kind of fun to hear my Cambodian name. So I'm kind of just bringing that back. But yeah, so that's what.
You have a beautiful name. You have a beautiful name, and it's not. It's. Oh, I don't think it's hard to remember or difficult to pronounce at all.
Oh,
I think.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I think it's a really great name. I love it. So yeah, this food fight. Fuck. This is it. That's like live. Live, love, laugh, or what is it? Laugh,
love.
Eat, yeah, right.
I guess it's my variation of those.
I love it, and I see the Savage Buddha shirt and this. Your comics too. I would love to show these comics to our audience a little bit. We don't have to show them all. Let them go through. So, do you have different styles? Because it looks like you can draw very photorealistic, but you can also draw very abstractly and like in cartoon, in real cartoon form. How do you sort of decide how you're going to draw something? Is it based on a feeling or is it?
So for the more comic stuff, those are inspired by actual, you know, moments in my life, particularly when I'm training or you know, just being a woman in martial arts. So you know I kind of like bring out the comedy in that, and I like to get these ideas out fast. That's why the drawings are a little more loose and more cartoony. So that's why. And then there's illustrations where like the trifecta one where I like to go more into detail with the and take my time with it. And so
I love it. I love this one with the wrist locks and this boyfriend. He looks like a Meeseeks from Rick and Morty.
Nice.
Right? These are very cool. Do you have a separate Instagram for your comics as well? Or are they all, everything's on your website?
Everything is on my website and I post stuff on my Instagram. I've been thinking of creating a separate account for my art instead of my dog, which is what I have right now, but I need to change that. I'll make it for my art instead of Azog. But yeah.
And what's your dog's name?
Azog the Defiler.
Azog the Defiler.
I don't know if you guys have seen The Hobbit, but he's named after the big mean pale orc that's in there because, you know, obvious resemblance. He's so big and scary.
I have to ask, because on behalf of our audience, when they go to your site, the first comic they see is this. I think it's a very funny little dog comic, and it looks like. Are you holding a phone, or you're holding a phone, and the dog is just colliding into your abdomen or something? It's Cooter Bruiser. Cooter Bruiser.
Yeah. That's that's something that, you know, it actually happened with my dog. I was on my phone and I was sitting on the ground and he wanted attention. So he was kind of just getting up from a nap, so he wasn't really paying attention, but he was also very enthusiastic. So he ran and he like just smashed his head right into my cooter. So that's how Cooter Bruiser came about.
Excellent. He lives up to his name.
Yeah, I recently learned it was from this comic that I learned the term from Lev, a butter dog. And then they've just legalized bestiality in Canada. I know this is like the taboo pushing that it's like we wanted to stay away from. And I'm like, I'm just diving in because it's like, what is going? This is like, it's just so funny. But I think that stuff doesn't. People are weird. It's oh my goodness. People get uptight about the most innocent things. You can't even make a comic or a joke or clearly things like people eat veal, right? People eat tortured baby cow, as South Park will mention, but then, you know, like a silly cartoon or something makes people's minds suddenly go into like they're imagining, you know the dog eating festival in China or something, and I feel like like people haven't yet emotionally regulated themselves to be able to distinguish, you know, like what's taboo, what isn't taboo, like why are the things that are taboo, and how do we emotionally exfoliate ourselves so we can elevate dialogues and sort of enjoy this new global culture that's emerging, facilitated by the internet, you know, and making conversations like this possible.
Right.
But I wouldn't want what Savonnery is doing to become commonplace, because then I think it loses its spice. There should be some kind of a line that someone like Savonnery crosses for that interest to be there. Like if everybody just admit like, oh, this is completely normal, this is just a run-of-the-mill stuff, I don't think it would have as much impact. Just like curse words. I think what makes curse words is that they do have a taboo about them. And the more they're used, the less taboo there is, the less effective they are doing what they're doing. And in fact, that takes me back to the ideas of tantric yoga, where certain practices, including sexual intercourse and eating meat and fish, were back in those times considered to be very taboo. But it was because they were taboo that when those taboos were crossed and the yogi ate the meat and fish and had sex, that it was able to have the power that it does. So in a way, I think you're also secreting that kind of power by pushing those boundaries. So as far as whether it's a good idea for those boundaries to be there or not to be there, I don't know. That's
right.
The point is, I'm glad you're doing it, and I hope you keep doing it and get even more extreme.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so far I've only had positive reactions. So I mean, I like to try to push buttons, but so far everybody's kind of just like, they get a good laugh from it, which is what I'm hoping for. So.
Well, Savonnery, thank you so much for being our guest. You are amazing, and I hope to have you back here again if you're interested. Like, you're going to keep growing right now, and I can't wait to see the next fight you're going to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, guys. This was a blast.
It was so nice to meet you, Savonnery. Thank you. You're a real-life superhero, for real. You're an inspiration. You so it's incredible. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you guys enjoyed this, please like, comment, subscribe, and don't forget to click that bell for more updates. Take care.